supporting WHYY Penn Medicine, helping to find new cures for cancer. With life-saving clinical trials and advanced surgical techniques, Penn Medicine is offering more hope for patients everywhere. Learn more at PennMedicine.org/cancer. Penn Medicine, what's next?
2 days after the Philadelphia District Attorney's Office concluded there was insufficient evidence to bring charges against the engineer involved in the May 2015 derailment of Amtrak Train 188, a Philadelphia municipal court judge yesterday ordered prosecutors to instead bring charges against Brandon Bostian in the case, resulting in 8 fatalities and hundreds of injuries. I'm Dave Heller, and this is NewsWorks Tonight. Joining me to help navigate the legal twists and turns is Temple University law professor Jules Epstein. Jules, thanks for joining us on NewsWorks Tonight.
Glad to be here.
What happened between Tuesday and Thursday where this order seems to have been reversed?
I don't know if it happened then. They may have prepared earlier. But the private lawyers representing victim families filed what is called a private criminal complaint. There's a process in Pennsylvania law that a person can file a complaint and essentially say to the district attorney's office, here's our complaint. We believe someone was injured, that the law was broken criminally. Would you now take this case over and bring the charges?
On the face of it, it seems rather simple. Does that happen all the time?
It happens mostly on very low-level crimes, like neighbor-to-neighbor crimes, where the police aren't witnesses. Only rarely will it happen in a high-profile, high-injury case.
So what was the basis by which the judge instead found that there was sufficient evidence to proceed?
The judge had to make a ruling based only on the papers she was handed. Essentially, she was given a complaint drafted by the victim family's lawyers, which, and I've read it, told part of the story, essentially in the light most damaging to the engineer, made him look really reckless. The district attorney on that form has a tiny box, reasons for declination. Instead of attaching a lengthy explanation with the extra facts, they just wrote in 2 or 3 bullet point legal justifications. So the judge, instead of dealing with the whole case, was left with a very, I'm going to call it artificial or incomplete picture. And by law, she had to rule on the papers in front of her.
So it sounds on the face of it that the district attorney's office was remiss.
Maybe. This is a fairly rare thing. And so I fear that what happened is somebody said, well, these are the normal explanations. Let's write them in here, too. Not taking a deep look at the law. Because challenges like this don't happen that often. If a district attorney's office says, well, we've read the papers, this just doesn't meet the legal definition. Here, the definition for reckless. And that's their only reason. Then the judge does her own fresh review. And when you read the papers as written in this most damaging way, it looks reckless. What they should have done, and to the best of my knowledge, did not, was attach an extra sheet or two of paper to this document saying, here's our laundry list, because they actually did a fairly exhaustive investigation and had a lot of reasons, not just law reasons, but good public policy reasons to say, we're not going to prosecute this case.
So because of that, let's call it undue brevity, now this is going on to the state attorney general's office.
That's right. That's only a beginning, because the state attorney general has the duty, and I'd say the ethical responsibility, to take a completely fresh look at this. And they would certainly have the right, if they go beyond the one-sided affidavit, to look at everything and say, you know what? We do want to prosecute this. You know what? We don't. You know what? We want to seek jail for this guy. You know what? Pre-trial probation is fine. They should have the full range, because the only order they have is file the complaint. It's been filed. Now they have to do what prosecutors are supposed to do, be fair.
But in turn, the state attorney general's office will now reopen whatever is known about the investigation into, in this case, Brandon Bastian, his past that day.
Whether they will reopen it or just say, hey, turn everything over to us, because there's been such an exhaustive investigation. I'm not sure they have to do their own, but they certainly have a lot of documents to read. So they will go through their own exhaustive review of everything that's already been uncovered. They might say, you know, we need more investigation. They might say, there's been plenty.
Jules Epstein, thanks for joining us on NewsWorks Tonight.
Thank you.
Temple University Law Professor Jules Epstein. You can hear much more of our conversation at newsworks.org. Mother's Day Sunday. Some people shell out money to take mom to brunch or buy flowers. Others may ignore it as a Hallmark holiday. In Philadelphia, a coalition of groups is marking the occasion by raising money to bail women with children out of jail. WHYY's Katie Culinary reports.
One-third of the people sitting in Philadelphia's jails are there because they've been accused but not convicted of a crime. Many of them just can't afford to pay bail. A coalition of groups pushing to end the city's cash bail system is calling attention to the issue by taking part in National Mama's Bailout Day. Organizer Hiram Rivera says they started small, hoping to raise $6,000 over the course of the week.
We met that and exceeded that by $4,000 the first day. And so we upped it to $10,000 because the more money that we have, the more women we can bail out. And it just keeps growing and growing and growing.
As of this afternoon, they've raised more than $30,000 from about 700 people. Tomorrow, the groups will head to Riverside Correctional Facility, hoping to bail out 15 to 20 women in time to reunite with their families on Mother's Day. Any money left over will go to help other women next week.
I think it's a overwhelming condemnation of the bail system that people are so eager to give money.
Sarah Morris with the No 215 Jail Coalition says there are serious repercussions for women who get stuck in jail because they can't pay. She tells the story of one woman who was released in January after 3 years on $10,000 bail.
Which means that if she'd had $1,000, she could have gotten out. And she was a mother, and she lost custody of her kids during that time and lost, you know, a lot of connections and support. And at the end of those 3 years, the charges were dismissed.
The coalition plans to help the women released tomorrow with housing, job training, and other supports. Katie Culinary, WHYY News.
On this 2017 Mother's Day weekend, let's examine the status of the more than 70% of moms with children younger than the age of 18 that are working. Wallet Hub's 2017 state-by-state analysis points to interesting disparities in our tri-state region. Let's break down the numbers with Jill Gonzalez, analyst with Wallet Hub. Jill, thanks for joining us on NewsWorks Tonight.
Thanks for having me, Dave.
What are the criteria by which this best and worst states analysis is put together?
We looked at 13 different metrics here to really identify the best and worst, and those were across three different categories. One is childcare, everything from costs to quality to school systems. The second was professional opportunities. We, of course, examined the gender pay gap from state to state, as well as the ratio of female to male executives, female unemployment rates, and the like. And finally, we looked at work-life balance, and that really keys in on state parental leave policies.
And are those three general categories pretty much equally weighted?
Yes, equally weighted here.
And so toward that end, New Jersey comes in three, right behind it, Delaware, Pennsylvania, 40. What explains that huge disparity?
Well, the tri-state area is pretty interesting here. So we have New Jersey and Delaware, both heavily blue states, and their policies and professional opportunities speak to that. When we divided this against policy lines, political lines, we saw that red states ranked 33rd on average out of all 50 states plus D.C. Blue states' average ranking was more like 16th. So because Pennsylvania is a little bit of a split, that's what accounts for this difference, especially when it comes to things like parental leave policy and like professional opportunities specifically for working women.
I don't know if it would hold up to scientific rigor, but one correlation I thought of was that New Jersey and Delaware have had female governors. Not so for Pennsylvania.
Yeah, you're absolutely right. I mean, we look into how well women are represented across industries. One of them is public administration, where there have historically been representation, better representation in both New Jersey and Delaware than in Pennsylvania.
And so toward that end, what onus shall we put on government to do more to support working mothers, particularly in Pennsylvania?
Well, this is something that we've seen in a state as close as New York, as far as California, you know, how they've really become trailblazers in this discussion. And a lot of it comes from the ground up. Instead of waiting for your state to make up legislation, turn this into law, a lot of companies in those states specifically have started incorporating policies that they then take to the local level that then gets brought to the state level. Things like paid sick leave policies, robust childcare subsidies, Medicaid expansion is definitely under question right now. But universal preschool programs as well. I mean, we talk about universal health care, but not necessarily these universal preschool programs. So all of these could be implemented, certainly at the state level, eventually. Until then, I think it's up to our organizations and to our companies to start implementing these on their own.
Jill Gonzalez, thanks so much for shedding light on NewsWorks tonight.
Anytime.
Jill Gonzalez, analyst with Wallet Hub. You can hear more of our conversation at newsworks.org. Homeless people are on their feet a lot. They search for food, shelter, and work. But they don't often spend much time taking care of their bodies or their minds. WHYY's Aaron Mozell reports that a new program in Philadelphia aims to change that through dance.
It's Friday afternoon, dance time at Broad Street Ministry in Center City. First, a little warm-up.
Start to roll the head to the right. Good. Start to roll the head to the right.
Inside the church's spacious sanctuary, about a dozen homeless people sit in a circle with John Martin, a longtime dance instructor with the Pennsylvania Ballet. He comes here each week to lead what he calls a soiree, an hour-long workshop. Martin says the goal is simple.
Just to start moving, just to get them moving in ways that they may have not been doing for a while.
Broad Street's executive director is Michael Dahl. He says for a population that doesn't typically have good access to health care, the class's physical benefits are obvious. But there's more to it. He says homeless people are also aesthetically insecure, meaning they don't have much access to beautiful things or moments that make them feel beautiful.
The ability to come in and think of their body as an instrument for art, and to lose touch with their body, to use it in beautiful ways, to me is, it's transportative.
And a vehicle for hitting the pause button on the constant stress of simply surviving. Dahl says that break from the day-to-day struggle of being homeless can give people the mental space to think about getting back on their feet, the metaphorical ones.
You get a chance to start thinking of things that are higher order, about what are my hopes? What are my dreams? What am I going through? Can I work through issues that are bothering me?
Jabril became homeless about 2 years ago after an uncle he was living with died, but he's always been the creative type. A lot of drawing, not much dancing. Still, Jabril says he enjoys Martin's class. It lifts his spirit.
They don't judge how you dance, I guess. Yeah, they don't. They, you know, you express yourself and do what you can, and it works out.
We're withholding Jabril's last name to protect his privacy and his chance to find permanent housing.
And reach and put it down. Right arm goes over. Oh, wonderful way to start a Friday afternoon, yes?
The warm-up over, the chairs are cleared for some ballet. Followed by a line dance backed by an aging boombox.
JT is the artist, Justin Timberlake. Yes? All right, meaning, get some shoulders going in it. Get some hips going in it. Yeah? Get a little, let go a little bit.
Letting go, that's easier said than done. Kimberly has been homeless for a little over 2 years after an injury forced her to file for disability.
It's not very relaxing, and then a lot of times you get moved from place to place because the police don't want certain people at a certain location. Even though you're not doing anything wrong, you're just sitting there quietly. It gets frustrating.
She says the arts have always been her way of blowing off steam. She says she feels great after the ministry's movement class.
Very calm, very just sedated, you know, kind of like I just went on a vacation.
Michael Dahl, the ministry's executive director, says the class is equally therapeutic for staffers who spend most of their time working through the challenges of being homeless with people trying to turn things around.
I know a lot of people that love to come by and just walk by the dance class, the movement class, because they know they're going to see smiles. They're going to see people enjoying themselves. They're going to see a wonderful moment. And we hang on those moments because that's what fills us back up to come back the next week and do what we do.
The current version of the workshop will wrap up with a performance at the end of the month, but there's already talk of keeping it going. Aaron Moselle, WHYY News.
This weekend, the Delaware Art Museum in Wilmington opens an exhibition of work by the oldest informal artist collective in the region. Called Assemblage, the 17 artists have been supporting one another for 32 years. WHYY's Peter Crimmins reports that this is its most high-profile show so far.
Assemblage started out the way most artist collectives do. After graduating from art school, artists realized they no longer have that institutional support system. Rosalind Bloom graduated from the Pennsylvania Academy of the Fine Arts in 1985 and asked her friends if they wanted to meet every month to talk about their work.
It would be kind of potluck. We would bring food and hang out. We really have all become good friends. I mean, over 32 years of meeting. You know, life happens. Whatever can happen has happened. And we've been there for each other as to support each other as artists and as friends.
In a region known for its informal artist collectives, Bloom is hard-pressed to identify one that has lasted longer. There has been a good amount of turnover in the last 3 decades, during which time it has held 16 exhibitions, usually at colleges and art centers. At the Delaware Art Museum, there is a gallery reserved for community exhibitions, and it will be the largest show for Assemblage, whose members range widely in style, content, and material. The only commonality among them is that they are all women. That is not by design or by charter. Bloom said the group just evolved that way.
Even though there are people in the group who were very strongly against the idea of identifying themselves as women artists. No, we're not women artists, we're artists. Nevertheless, we never invited a man in. We would discuss it and then drop it. It never happened.
The exhibition of work by Assemblage will remain at the Delaware Art Museum through the summer. Peter Crimmins, WHYY News.
As the circumstances surrounding President Donald Trump's firing of FBI Chief James Comey continue to emerge, the public at this juncture does not give the move a hearty endorsement. Let's get into it with Frank Newport, editor-in-chief at the Gallup poll. Hi, Frank.
Hello, Dave.
Frank, the firing was disclosed late Tuesday afternoon. What impression has it made to date?
Well, we were in the field Wednesday and Thursday night, have data now. Interestingly, Dave, we asked exactly the same question that we asked back in June of 1993 when then-President Bill Clinton fired an FBI director, William Sessions. Same wording, just changed the names. Now we find 39% of Americans approve of Donald Trump's firing of James Comey. Back then in 1993, it was 44% who approved of Bill Clinton. But the big difference was back in 1993, only 24% disapproved. It was a much larger don't know, don't have an opinion. Now, we've got 39% approving of Trump's decision, but 46% who disapprove. So it's a net negative of -7 for Trump's decision. Back when Clinton fired Sessions, it was a +20. So there's a big difference between now and when the last president fired an FBI director some 24 years ago.
Safe to say the circumstances were very different as well, Frank. As you recall, in 1993, the Department of Justice produced an extensive internal report in January. Clinton acted in July, among other things, accusing Sessions of improprieties, abusing his power, misusing funds, et cetera, et cetera.
Yes, big differences. And of course, there's also a big difference in the political environment now. Again, we had a bigger don't know then. in 93 when we asked the public. And part of that may be that we have increased partisanship now based on what we had back then. And it may not even matter the specifics about what President Trump is doing. Republicans are going to like it. Democrats aren't.
Was Russia, or specifically Comey, even on the radar in the public last week?
It certainly was not prior to the firing when we ask Americans, as we do every month, what's the most important problem facing the nation? We didn't find anything about Russia or possibility of collusion between Russia and the U.S. or U.S. government officials. None of that came up top of mind for Americans. Actually, what was top of mind was our perennial problem, which is dysfunctional government. That includes mentions of Trump by name, mentions of Congress being dysfunctional, mentions that the whole government system isn't working.
Some would certainly cite it as evidence of dysfunction, specifically in the White House, the clamor among many to have Trump's daughter Ivanka and son-in-law Jared Kushner have more influence.
Well, certainly Ivanka has a better image in the eyes of Americans than does her father, Donald Trump. 47% of Americans say they have a favorable opinion of first daughter Ivanka Trump, 36% unfavorable. And in the same poll, we ask about her father, Donald Trump, and it flipped. He has a more negative than positive image. So she right now has a higher, don't know, but basically Ivanka's better liked, particularly by Democrats. There's a softer view of her than of Donald Trump. She has a better image than her father.
Perhaps analogous to times during the Obama presidency when Michelle's favorables were higher than her husband's.
That's right. We've asked many times about first ladies, and it is certainly not unusual that a first lady will have higher ratings than her husband. Good observation, Dave. She has higher ratings than her father.
Thanks, Frank.
You bet, Dave.
Frank Newport, editor-in-chief at the Gallup Poll. He joins us each week at this time on NewsWorks Tonight. That's all for tonight's show. NewsWorks Tonight is produced by Shai Ben-Yaakov, Kimberly Haas, Ty Johnson, and Brett Rader. At the helm this week, Al Banks, Diana Martinez, and Adam Staniszewski. Sandra Clark is Vice President of News and Civic Dialogue. John Musoni is Assistant Vice President for News Operations, and our News Director is Eugene Son. Thanks for joining us, and have a great weekend. I'm Dave Heller for NewsWorks Tonight.